The reading is 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 1 to 16, and it's on page 1148 of the Pew Bibles. Now, for the matters you wrote about, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman. But since sexual immorality is occurring, each man should have sexual relations with his own wife, and each woman with her own husband. The husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife, and likewise the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but yields it to her husband. In the same way, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but yields it to his wife. Do not deprive each other, except perhaps by mutual consent and for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer. Then come together again so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. I say this as a concession, not as a command. I wish that all of you were as I am, but each of you has your own gift from God. One has this gift, another has that. Now to the unmarried and the widows, I say, it is good for them to stay unmarried, as I do. But if they cannot control themselves, they should marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion. To the married, I give this command, not I, but the Lord. A wife must not separate from her husband. But if she does, she must remain unmarried, or else be reconciled to her husband. And a husband must not divorce his wife. To the rest, I say this, I, not the Lord. If any brother has a wife who is not a believer, and she is willing to live with him, he must not divorce her. And if a woman has a husband who is not a believer, and he is willing to live with her, she must not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband has been sanctified through his wife, and the unbelieving wife has been sanctified through her believing husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean, but as it is, they are holy. But if the unbeliever leaves, let it be so. The brother or sister is not bound in such circumstances. God has called us to live in peace. How do you know, wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, husband, whether you will save your wife? This is the word of the Lord.
Let's pray together. Lord, may the words of my mouth and the thoughts of all our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. So this morning's sermon, there will be notes. There are notes available here on the front row if you would like to take them away at the end. I've not given them out so that you listen rather than just read. But if you want to take notes away at the end, you're allowed to do that. Sex! I said it, and I know that some people are fed up with talking about it, but it's in the Bible. You see, word gets back to me what people say after the service. So if you don't like it, I'm sorry, but we're going through Corinthians, and it's there. So we begin with sex again. And the good thing about that is it's a gift from God. And part of the problem with the church is we don't talk about stuff that is slightly embarrassing or slightly awkward. That's kind of why the church is in the mess it's in, because we've never really got to grips with talking honestly and openly about real stuff in the real world. So are we going to be the kind of church that's prepared to do that and talk about difficult things that might be slightly embarrassing for us or not? If you say not, that's probably the wrong answer. And we're going to face some problems together, if that's the case. So we're going to think a little bit about marriage and singleness and the difficulties that come with separation and divorce this morning. So this is quite tricky, could be a little bit painful for us as we go into this stuff this morning, and there might be slightly less humour than there was. So we can't promise that because, you know, sometimes humor just comes through. That's just what happens. But it's fairly serious stuff that we're going to look at. So let's delve into this passage together. It would be helpful for you and for me as the preacher if you had the Bible open in front of you. So it's page 1148, as Ali said, in the Pew Bibles. Now, Paul's writing in response to questions or things that the people in Corinth were talking about, problems that the church was facing. And quite clearly, there were a lot of marital issues going on in the church in Corinth. Marriage is not easy. Put your hand up if you can agree with that statement. Marriage is not easy. But a lot of those who are married, some people, no, it's fine, it's really easy. But for a lot of folk, it's not easy. It's not easy to be Wrong answer. And kind of Paul alludes to that at the beginning, doesn't he, this chapter, when he says this. Now, for the matters you wrote about, it's good for a man not to marry. I think it says in the 2011 version, it's good for a man not to have sexual relations. Probably what was going on in his mind at that point is, you know, there was an anticipation that Jesus is coming back very, very soon. That's what how the early church was operating. And Paul's thoughts are that, you know, for him, he had learned how he could serve the Lord as a single person. And that was probably his driving force here. Much of what he says here is coming from him and from what God had taught him about life. But basically, the culture in which he lived is kind of, he's trying to speak in a way that goes against the flow of the culture. He's trying to say that there are things that the church, Christians, followers of Jesus, needs to do. They need to do things which are different from the way of the world. So here's some examples of that. Verse 2, he says, but since there's so much immorality, it's kind of interesting that he describes it like that. Since there's so much immorality, you know, the world has not changed so much since the first century. We still live in a world where kind of we have confusing thoughts about sexual morality and what should be and what shouldn't be. And what we are kind of bombarded with, perhaps it's even greater because the imagery that is all around us that we're bombarded with in all sorts of ways is so much greater than it would have been in the first century. But since there is so much immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. And what he seems to be saying there is that there should be no polygamy. You know that word? There should be no polygamy. You should only have one husband or one wife. You shouldn't have more than one of either. How anyone could contemplate having more than one wife, I have. It's hard work having, and one husband as well, not to be sexist about it. But you know something, we live in a culture where things are moving rapidly, and let me put this out there, some of you will disagree with this and you will say stuff like, this will never happen. This will never happen. In our culture, it will never happen. Polygamy, the idea of having what's called polyamorous relationships, i.e. having more than one partner, it will never happen. Some of you are saying it in your heart and in your head right now. David, you're just being ridiculous. Scott put up the slide for us. I don't know if you saw this article that originally appeared in The Sun. I know that you all are great Sun readers, yeah? I personally don't read The Sun. I read this in the New York Post. Came up in my timeline, but it's about a young man. He's actually an Englishman from East London who lives in America, and he has two partners, Jane Shalakova and Brooke Shedd. His name is Adam Lyons, and he is in a kind of married relationship with these two women, and they're bringing up children together. And the great thing is, he's always able to go out with one of them while the other one stays at home and the babysitting. And it's great. And they've got a great relationship. It's open. They're thinking about they might bring in a fourth person into the relationship because they've got an open relationship. Sounds great, eh? And I'm going to recommend that the church adopts this as a new policy. But what's to stop it? What's wrong with it? Why would we say that it's not a good thing? Because these people love each other. So it must be, it should, it's okay. We've got no argument against it. If people love each other, it must be okay. So watch for this. You will look back in 10 years' time and go, I remember when Dave McCarthy said that this would become a norm and a trend. And I poo-pooed it then. You wait.
I wish I could put money on these kind of things and predict that they were going to happen. I could become a very rich man if I was a betting man. That's the kind of direction I think our society is headed in, increasing acceptance of those kind of relationships. Paul says, one man, one woman. You should have one partner. In other words, no polygamy. Be focused on that single relationship. In spite of your desire to have other people, to be alongside other people because of your tendency to adultery, you need to focus on the one person that God has placed you with. He then goes on in verses 3 and 4 to talk about the responsibilities of being in relationship. He talks about it in terms of sexual relationship, but he's talking in general about if you're going to be in a relationship, you're responsible to one another. You belong to one another. The two become one flesh. Two become one. You belong to one another. Not in the sense of ownership, but it's not about rights. It's not about your control. You don't have rights over the other person. It's my right. I demand this of you. It's not about that. It's the responsibilities you have to put the other person first. Their needs, their desires. That's why being married is so difficult. That's what makes marriage work. If you put the other person first, you will have a strong marriage. If you are selfish before you get married and you maintain your selfishness, keeping your marriage going will be more difficult. You will make the other person unhappy. Their unhappiness might lead to their desires leading them away from you. Paul is arguing you need to know your responsibilities, not demand your rights of one another, but recognize your responsibilities under God to put the other person first. Clearly, there was a problem in Corinth that couples were not doing that. They weren't taking the responsibilities seriously. He then goes on in verse 5 to talk about the importance of abstinence and having a prayer life. Now, this is probably one of the most difficult verses in the whole of this chapter. You probably didn't realize that as we read it, but it's a really difficult verse, not because of the sexual aspect of it, but simply because it says, in order to pray together. One of the hardest things for any couple to do is to pray together. If you are in a married relationship and your partner shares your faith, getting down to the wonderful business of praying together is actually quite difficult for most of us. It's a thing that we will struggle with. But Paul clearly says here, you know, it may be that you abstain in order, for a little while, not for a long time. You know, you can't hide behind this and say, I'm going to be praying, therefore we're not going to be in bed together. You know, using it as a kind of defense mechanism. It's the idea that your unity, your intimacy, isn't just about the physical, it's about a spiritual unity as well. It's one of the things that is really important in married life, that you have a spiritual unity as well as a physical unity and an emotional unity. Those of us who follow Jesus recognize that that is important. So he talks in great detail about that. It's okay to be abstaining if you're praying for a time. So one of the things that we might pick up this morning, if we're married, is that we might say, well, do you know something? Maybe we need to be praying together. We might say to our partner, maybe we need to find a way, but despite our embarrassment and our awkwardness, maybe we can find a way to pray with one another. Maybe something we haven't done ever. Maybe it's something we've not done for a while. Maybe we will set aside time to be people who pray together. And then Paul goes on in verse 5. He kind of gets into this business about what Satan is up to. Then come together again so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. So I guess he's thinking that someone might run off and find another partner for satisfaction. But the idea behind it is this. Satan, the devil, is going to constantly be seeking ways to undermine marriage. He will attack what God has given. And Paul's saying, watch out for the devil's way. He's like a roaring lion, as Peter tells us. He's like a roaring lion wandering around looking for someone to devour. And if you're married, if you're a married person, that marriage relationship is one of the ways that he will try to trap you and seduce you and tempt you by things not going right. So it's your responsibility to do everything in your power to make sure that your marriage works well. Hence why I need to fix the curtain this afternoon. so that that doesn't become a bigger issue than it really is. Because it's quite a small issue, isn't it? Yes, it is. But it could become a big issue. So we recognize the things that are there that might become problems before they become huge problems, and the devil uses them to drive wedges between us. Phew, that's a sermon in itself, really. We'll go on a little bit further. Paul then moves on. He kind of begins to talk about personal advice in verses 6 to 9. I say this as a concession, not as a command. I wish that all men were as I am, but each man has his own gift from God. One has this gift, another has that. And then he talks about to the unmarried and the widows. I say it's good for them to stay unmarried as I am. But if they cannot control themselves, they should marry. For it is better to marry than to burn with passion. And so Paul has this kind of passion for singleness. Singleness is a gift and a blessing. Some of us long to not be single, but Paul seems to recognize that as being a significant place, a calling from God, a gift that people have. He recognizes it's important. And at this point, Paul himself seems to have been single. And he recognizes that he functions better as a single person in the kind of ministry that God has given him. Remember what Paul was doing. He's traveling. He's spending a lot of time in different places. He's away. He doesn't have a roof over his head. But he has the gift of singleness. Now, the truth is this. It's unlikely that Paul had been single throughout his life. As a Pharisee, as a Jewish religious teacher, as a rabbi, it was almost have been certain that he would have been married. What we don't know is whether he was a widow, he'd lost his wife to death, or some people theorize that he was separated from his wife, that when he came to faith, remember what happened to Paul on the road to Damascus when he was Saul, the persecutor of Christians, and Jesus appeared to him. And he had this amazing conversion and was blinded and then was made to see again. The Lord revealed himself to him very powerfully. The theory is this, that Saul, who was named Paul, renamed Paul, was married. And when he began to follow Jesus, his wife did not follow Jesus with him. We don't know this, it's just a theory, but it might explain verses like verse 15 and later on in chapter 7, verse 40, when he talks about the unbelieving partner. Maybe, just maybe, Paul was speaking from his own experience, difficult experience of having been married and no longer being married. He speaks with pastoral love and pastoral care about some of the difficulties that maybe he experienced. But what he says is, being single is significant and important. I once had a bishop say to me when I went to tell him that, I told him that I was going to remain single for the rest of my life, and then I met Ali, and I went to tell him that I was thinking that we might get married. I'd asked her, and she'd said yes. And he looked at me, knowing that I'd said I was going to remain single, and he looked into my eyes and he said, "You don't have the gift of being single, and I knew you would find it really hard." And it was a blessing that he was able to encourage me in that. I was quite discouraged by it, actually, because I really did think that I had the gift of singleness. But for some of us, that's the place that we've been called to. It's the place that God will use us and strengthen us and help us to be his agent, to be on his mission to make Jesus known. Paul goes on. He moves from his counter-cultural approach to marriage to the personal advice about his position, his singleness, to the whole issue of divorce. And this is where it gets difficult. Remember the situation in Corinth? There were two kind of streams in the life of the church. There were those who were legalistic, and there were those who were into license, basically anything goes. those who had a narrow, a very kind of tight view that only these certain things could happen, and those who said anything could go. These were the besetting problems of the church in Corinth. People who were too tough and people who were too soft. And clearly there was an issue in that culture, which remembers the Greco-Roman culture, with divorce. Divorce would have been very, very common in that culture. So much so that if you got divorced, it was almost compulsory in Roman culture that you should get remarried. You had to do it within a certain time. You had to get remarried really, really quickly, because it wasn't, particularly if you were young. But people were divorcing left, right, and center. It was an easy thing to do. And again, counterculturally, the followers of Jesus believed that divorce was not a good thing. Divorce is not a good thing. It's kind of derived from the Old Testament teaching in passages like Deuteronomy chapter 24, and particularly a verse like in the prophets, the minor prophet Malachi, where Malachi in chapter 2 and verse 16, one rendering of that verse is, God hates divorce. And it's because it represents the tearing, the breaking of humanity's relationship with him. If marriage is the two becoming one flesh, a man and a woman coming together in relationship, representing the bond between God and humanity, Jesus, the bridegroom, and the church, the bride, when a divorce takes place between a man and a woman, somehow that breaks the heart of God, because it kind of reflects that breaking of relationship that human beings have with him. It's a serious business. It's a serious business when a marriage ends. Paul would have been aware of the teaching of the Pharisees. There were Pharisees like Hillel and Akiba, who taught, who loved to teach from Deuteronomy chapter 24. Deuteronomy 24 goes like this. It says, if a man marries a woman who becomes displeasing to him, he was allowed to divorce. So if a man is with a woman and she is displeasing, if her cooking isn't up to scratch, or she's no longer as beautiful as she once was, then you can put her away and divorce her and hook up with someone else. And so some rabbis had got into the business of kind of justifying easy divorce. And so when Jesus in Matthew chapter 19 challenges them on that, he says, you need to remember what Deuteronomy 24 actually says. Not that you can divorce for any reason, but actually you need to be careful. In fact, Deuteronomy 24 says this, if a man marries a woman who becomes displeasing to him, and then it goes on to say, because he finds something indecent about her, i.e. there's some immorality, she's done something which is out with the bounds of what should be happening in a marriage, at that point a certificate of divorce can be granted. And Jesus is saying in that passage, look, there are some grounds, because of your weakness, your human weakness, there are some grounds that might be okay. But not every ground for divorce is all right. In fact, it seems to be biblically the grounds for divorce would be porneia, which we commonly render as adultery, but actually is a little bit wider than just adultery. It's anything that indicates unfaithfulness to the marriage vows. That might be the cause of a divorce. Paul goes on to talk about if someone does not believe, if your partner, if you come to faith and your partner is not a believer and they walk away, at that point, it might be that there needs to be a separation, there needs to be a divorce. But actually, that's not a route that you should necessarily go back to. Jesus in chapter 19 goes back, chapter 19 of the Gospel of Matthew goes back to the roots of marriage. He quotes from Genesis chapter 1 and verse 27 and chapter 2 of Genesis verse 24. And he goes back to the very roots of marriage and says, for this purpose, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife in that one flesh relationship. The two belong together. Jesus wants them to be reminded of that. To recognize, yes, divorce happens and it is hugely painful. There is a spiritual breaking. It's not just a physical and emotional breaking. There is a spiritual breaking that goes on. It is hugely painful when these things happen. And Jesus recognizes that. But he says to the Pharisees, you make it way too easy to leave one person for another. In fact, your main thing is you see someone over there that you prefer more and you're going for that. Then there's the question of faith. And this is what Paul talks about in some detail. The question of faith of your partner. If any brother has a wife who's not a believer and she's willing to live with him, he must not divorce her. And if a woman has a husband who's not a believer and he's willing to live with him, she must not divorce him. So clearly in Corinth, this was an issue. Some people were giving up on their relationship. Oh, well, I'm a Christian now and my partner isn't a Christian, therefore I can leave him behind and find a nice Christian husband. But Paul's point is actually, if he's a loving, caring partner but doesn't share your faith, if he's committed to living with you and looking after you and caring for in the family, or she is prepared to do that and be committed to you, she's still in love with you, then you should do everything you can to make that marriage work. See, what Paul seems to be indicating here is that there is an opportunity to make a marriage work, but you have to choose to do that. Reconciliation is possible, and it should be strived for. If a woman has a husband who's not a believer and is willing to live with him, she must not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband has been sanctified through his wife, and the unbelieving wife has been sanctified through her believing husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean. But as it is, they are holy. You see, fascinating that this is, when a marriage breaks down, if it was only the couple that were facing, we don't love each other anymore, we're not happy with one another anymore, if it was only them that were affected by it, it would not be half as bad. But the reality is, the ripples that flow out from a marital breakdown are so very great. The children, the parents of the married couple, the friends of a couple who are married and breaks down and who wonder, who do we remain friends with? We want to remain friends with both of them. They want to be remain friends with. The ripples that go out from it, the damage that is done when a marriage breaks down is so great. And if you're with a partner who doesn't believe, who loves you and cares for you and treasures you and yet doesn't believe, you know, the hope is, the prayer is that you, by being in that marriage with them, might be an agent on mission to help bring that person to faith. I know that that's easy for me to say, but you know, I've experienced living with someone who did no longer believe, and it is hugely painful. I know that. I know how hard it is. But the calling that we have is to do everything we can to help that person see the love of God by what we do and what we say, and love them to take our responsibilities seriously. Paul indicates that we should strive as much as we can to keep marriages together. But if the unbeliever, verse 15 says this, but if the unbeliever leaves, let him do so. A believing man or woman is not bound in such circumstances. And Paul, at that point, is opening up the possibility that actually being apart may be necessary. Jesus seems to give the exception towards adultery, to porneia, what's called porneia in the New Testament. Paul here introduces the idea that divorce might be permissible, is permissible, in the face of being abandoned because of someone losing faith. Now, there's much more that could be said about this, but we don't have time this morning to go into it. But here's the thing. If Paul's right, and we should always strive to keep marriages together, and I believe that that's right, that we should always do that, even in the face of the most difficult circumstances. I sometimes tell the story about a couple who came to me. The husband came to me because her he discovered that his wife was having an affair. He'd been looking at her phone. You know, if your partner's looking at your phone regularly, has access code, it's usually a bad sign that trust is beginning to break down. And he'd looked at his wife's phone and there were messages there. And for a long time, she denied that anything was going on, but then opened up that, yes, she was having an affair with someone at work. And over the course of many, many months, I really thought, I was praying for them, I was meeting with them regularly. I thought, you know, this is going to end in divorce. I can't see in human terms how this couple can stay together. But over the course of many months, what became clear was that after the birth of their children, the woman had felt unloved by her husband. The husband had stopped telling her how much he loved her, how beautiful she was, and had stopped kind of affirming her. And life had been taken up by the children. And then this guy at work was giving her a little bit of attention and giving her what only her husband should have been giving her. And she kind of fell into that. And as that began, as the layers began to open up and become revealed, healing began to come as they began to talk and realize that they really did still love each other. Something really serious had happened. But there was an opportunity for forgiveness and reconciliation. And you know, 12 years later or so, that couple are still together. But they had to work through the pain and the trauma that they'd been subjected to through their own choice, through her own choice. And that always gives me hope, because even in the most extreme circumstances of adultery, it might just be possible, if the couple are open to the work of the Holy Spirit of reconciliation and peace and healing, that maybe, just maybe, healing and restoration can happen. Sometimes that doesn't happen, and the church needs to work out what to do in the face of that. You know, we need to help people through the difficulties of marital breakdown, to listen, to be patient, to try and be kind, to point people in the direction of reconciliation, but also to help people heal in the aftermath of the breakdown of our relationship. Not necessarily to judge, not to exclude, not to push away. Sometimes, too, we need to challenge folk. We need to say to people when they are running off with somebody else who's not their partner, this is not of God. It is not the best thing. You are damaging yourself. You're damaging your family. And you're breaking relationship with God in your disobedience. And we need to be challenging. Painful though that is, the behavior of people that try to justify that. But reconciliation is possible and should be strived for. So let me end by saying this. There are some books available. If you want to read more about this and find out more about it, I suggest some books on the handout that you might want to go away and read. Paul opens up the possibility of reconciliation and healing. I think he also opens up the possibility that in some circumstances, people need to begin again. They need to begin life again, because God is the God of the second chance. But the focus is to try and keep marriages together for the glory of God. And may we be a church that teaches this, teaches forgiveness and reconciliation, helps those who are going through marital difficulties, encourages them through that, helps those who hit the buffers and just cannot go on in a difficult marriage because vows are not being. Let's support people and help one another and love one another through all of that. And may that be done to the glory of God. Amen.